Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of March. We have education on the mind this hour, and we have much to talk about. Of course, the proposal for national standards for math and science that was talked about yesterday. Do we need a common body of knowledge? Do we need standards that are applicable all over the country? We also had that Rhode Island school board decision to fire the entire faculty of a poorly performing school, President Obama's endorsement of that action, which has stirred really a storm of reaction all over the country. Many teachers saying it's an insult. Many are saying that it's a watershed moment of school accountability. We have the race to the top funds. I don't fully understand this, why some states are getting the money, other states, including Wisconsin, are not getting the money, and there's another round of decisions to be made about other states. Why doesn't everybody get race to the top money is my question. Peter Blewett is our guest this hour, and we are going to be packed with phone calls, I'm sure. Peter is vice president of the Milwaukee School Board. His son has gone through Milwaukee Public Schools and is now a senior at the Milwaukee School of Languages. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Calling into the program at some point, Professor Barry Goldman Hall, who's a professor and program admissions director in the School of Social Work at San Jose State University. He wrote a piece that appeared in the New York Times. What day was this? Yesterday, actually. Talking about holding shamefully underpaid and underworked public school teachers solely responsible for the performance of students in a poor community is just ridiculous. So that's what's up. 800-486-8655 is the number, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Peter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, Kathleen, it's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, and taking on a wide range of topics. Education is very much in front of us this week.
Well, that's great. We need to be talking about education.
Yes.
Nothing, in my view, nothing's more important than how we're preparing the next generation.
I agree with you. Let's start with this, which was in the news so much yesterday, this whether or not we need a common body of knowledge, that we have states that differ pretty dramatically from state to state in what students study and how they're prepared to take tests, et cetera. Is this a good idea, do you think?
Well, I'm glad that we're talking about the subject of, you know, do we need a common body of knowledge? It's been something that's been debated for many years. E.D. Hirsch and all those people wanted to, you know, they thought that for an American society, the United States should have a common body of knowledge that all students would have, and that would help unify the country. In their view, the idea is attractive, but I've always been concerned about why don't we look at human development, what we understand about the brain, what we understand, look at the qualities that we want our children to have. I want the next generation to be critical thinkers, to be leaders, and how can we get those skills in our students? So I've always wanted to do certain things. I mean, I've got my own agenda, which is I think we need every student in the United States should be learning at least two languages, English, Spanish, French, German. They do that, you know, in the Netherlands. Every child speaks four languages.
Uh-huh.
And we are learning that development of language skills, you know, it helps with brain capacity development. So music education. We know that music instruction at different ages will enhance a student's ability to do analytical thinking, to do mathematical thinking. Every student should have the experience of theater because that helps them develop poise and other skills that they're going to need as they, you know, as they try to solve the tremendous problems that they're facing, as they try to meet the challenges that our society is going to hand to them. So I wish we would define the skills that we want our students to have. I wish that we would look at the way that the brain develops at different ages and make sure that what we're doing, our education policy, focuses on developing brain capacity, developing the skills that we know our students are going to need. I'm less concerned with, you know, how we get there. The reason that I chose to live in Milwaukee and moved from beautiful California out here was that one of the things that attracted me to this place was that there was an established Montessori system, you know, system of schools. They had the first public Waldorf. They had the language immersion schools, the schools for the arts. Those are what, you know, attracted me. Say, this is the place that I want to bring my family up. And I'm, you know, sort of mourning because my son is a senior at Milwaukee School of Languages. He is Milwaukee Public Schools. It does not have the level of funding that the school system that I went to had. But my son has, I think, received a superior education because he's had some choices. He's been in a diverse environment. It's been really a great, great opportunity for him. And I think that I would like to, you know, foster the things that work.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with this, with the common set of content standards, is that we're talking about reading and math. One of the problems I've had with education reform movement for years and years is that as we insist on more and more standards, more and more accountability, what I see happening is that our level of expectation for what our students know and can do goes down, down, and down. Why are we only focused on reading and math? You know, I posed that question to my students last semester, and they came up with a kind of very interesting response. They said, you know, I think that when you look at what we want our students to be able to do, we want them to be able to make our change. That's why we want them to do math, and we want them to be able to understand what we tell them to do. But we don't insist on writing so that they can actually articulate their concerns. So my problem is that we seem to be going down, racing down rather than up. I want to challenge our students. I want them to speak languages, to be able to make music, even if, like me, they do it very poorly. You know, I want them to really have a chance to explore what they're good at. And that means providing them different kinds of opportunities.
And yet, as you well know, as you look all over the country and as you look at MPS, the programs that are being cut for next year actually include language programs, include some music programs. Schools are going to have to scramble to figure out, you know, how to do another fundraiser to make all those programs go. They're not the priority, and I don't think they're the priority nationally. If they're so crucial, why is it so hard to keep them on the plate when it comes to full funding?
Well, because we've so dramatically underfunded our schools. And I think that, you know, one big thing that would help would be a national healthcare system that could really solve most local government problems, because so much of our cost has to do with healthcare benefits. If we had a decent system of national healthcare, that would just dramatically ease the crunch of local governments, whether it's city government or school government or county government. That'd be a big step forward. So I really wish that something would happen at the national level or at the state level. I was speaking to some people just yesterday, and the state really needs to move. We can't wait for the federal government to do things. The state needs to take the lead, and I've been disappointed by, you know, it seems we just haven't accomplished much at the state level. We need to look at healthcare, because we have a problem in the state. It's a problem that where Milwaukee has much in common with rural communities, because it's, you know, our farming community, they need decent health care and they have a problem getting it. And in our city, Milwaukee, one of the biggest problems we face with our students is that so many of them, because they're poor, don't have access to good health care. But of course, it would just immediately solve our local problem, which is the cost of health care for our teachers.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to Race to the Top for a moment. I don't fully understand why this program is making people in states and districts try out to get the money. It's a substantial amount of money that's going to a select number of states. There's been a lot, as you well know more than anybody, controversy about whether or not the mayoral control of MPS had to happen in order to get that fund. But two questions. One is, why did Wisconsin not get the money? And two, can you tell me a little bit about what seems to me to be an inequity here, that some places are getting money and some aren't? They're all our children, and they're all in the United States. So what's going on?
Well, I think that Representative Gwen Moore hit the nail on the head in this issue, and that is that the children of Milwaukee should not be, and the children of Madison and Monona should not be pitted against the children of Chicago. That just is, it's not fair. It's not just. Gwen Moore said that Lyndon Johnson saw education as a civil rights issue, and that if it's a civil rights issue, it doesn't make any sense to make it then a competitive issue, that some children are going to get some, other children are not. That I think that she's nailed the issue right there. I mean, you're right. Every community needs the money to educate their children. There should not be, I don't think the federal level should not be dumping money into one state and excluding most of the others. When we look at those federal policies, sometimes they have unintended consequences. Will people start leaving neighboring states to go to the states that have millions of dollars more to educate their kids from the federal level? If the federal government really wants to make a difference, they could live up to their promise of the Individual Disabilities Education Act and reimburse local districts 40% of the cost for those services. Right, last year it was, I believe, around 16% that the federal reimbursement. That is, you know, tens of millions of dollars that this community desperately needs to provide important services to kids who need it most, who have the face the greatest challenges. The federal government has never lived up to its promise to the kids who have special needs, and that's a problem. At the state level, we find the same thing: shrinking reimbursements for special education, but we're mandated to provide those services, and we should provide those. But the entities that make those laws should help us be able to provide those services. You're exactly right. We should not be competing against each other. We should be the race to the top. We should be looking at what are the best practices. Look at the science. Look at the work that's been done in the field. I think that the reason the race to the top application failed is that one of the reasons is that the Department of Public Instruction and the state did not reach out to local school boards, did not reach out to local districts, did not reach out to our teachers and get their input into the application. So the sections of the application that I've looked at, I don't see innovation there. For example, technical education. Milwaukee we've doubled the number of Project Lead the Way programs in the district. That's just been phenomenal for the students who have been able to participate mm-hmm. in it. And districts who are watching us are saying this is a great investment. They see what's happened. Milwaukee, we have the highest percentage of women and minority students enrolled in science, technology, engineering, and math courses. That's a great achievement. That's the kind of thing I think that we should be focusing on in our race to the top application. I invited the state superintendent to work with our board, and when he was here at a forum at Rufus King High School on the race to the top, and we weren't a part of that process. The DPI sent the application out to local districts and to the teachers' unions. After they had done the work, we had several questions about different parts of it. In the end, our board could only half-heartedly endorse the proposal without having, we didn't have a chance to read it all. We had many questions that did not, we were told we don't have time to answer these before we have to submit it. So we said, well, we endorse these elements of it, but we need to feel free to reserve our endorsement for parts that we don't have answers for. And so I think that as long as the state's going to pursue this kind of the race to the top funds from this top-down level, not involve the parents, not involve the really wonderful personnel we have here who have been working with partners and doing very innovative things in the Milwaukee area and all over the state, then, you know, it's hard for me to see how that would succeed. But I think the crucial point is the idea of having states compete against each other is simply wrong. The second thing I think is very important for people to understand is mayoral control did not play a part in the race to the top application. The state application was not truly innovative, and I believe that the reason that it wasn't is that it was created, you know, in hallways. And I think that there were a lot of people that did really good work on it. I'm not sure that that work was, you know, ended up inside the application that was forwarded to the federal government.
Peter Blewett is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have all our lines full, but you'll be able to get through eventually. We have yet to talk about, which is, of course, is a big issue, that Rhode Island School Board's decision to fire the faculty of a poorly performing school, the president endorsing the action, Secretary of Education endorsing the action, and there will be more schools that may be facing that as a result of No Child Left Behind, and also because of perhaps this example of tough love by the Obama administration. What do we think of that? So we'll welcome your phone calls. We'll go to them in just a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Marilyn Johnson will be joining us. She's the author of This Book is Overdue, How Librarians and Cybrarians Can Save Us All. She wrote a book about obituaries some time ago, and she found actually, and this is true, that the most interesting obituaries she found were of librarians. So we will talk about that the second hour of our program. Let's go to phone calls for Peter. We start with Nick from Milwaukee. Hello, Nick.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. I come from a family of teachers, God bless them. My dad was a local professor. My mother worked about over 25 years in the Milwaukee public school system. So the comments I have are fairly pointed. Number one, my mother originally went to one of those little normal schools in Minnesota, got her teaching certificate there, and she ended up teaching high school in the state of Minnesota and became a seasoned, experienced teacher. Then when my parents came to Milwaukee, my mother wanted to get a job with the Milwaukee Public Schools, and they wouldn't hire her. So what she did was substitute taught in the Milwaukee Public Schools, often in the inner core, for over 3 years. Then she asked again if they would hire her, and they declined. So she had to get a member of the school board to actually sponsor her so she could get hired by the Milwaukee school system. Then, once she was teaching in the Milwaukee system, she decided she would get her four-year degree in education. So she attended the School of Education at UWM, and because she was such an experienced teacher, she repeatedly referred to that place as a joke. Are you still there?
Yeah, we're here. She referred to what as a joke? MPS?
At the School of Education at UWM is a joke. It doesn't do anything to prepare teachers seriously for being serious teachers in the trenches.
It's Nick, when
was these educational fads?
When was this?
Oh, this was back in the 1960s.
Things may have changed, Peter.
Well, you know, I think Nick did say something that he was that he saw that there was a lot of kind of fad chasing. Mm-hmm. I guess what I would say is that our teachers get overwhelmed when they get directives from the top to do this or that new program, when districts chase money or, you know, they bring in new initiatives. We really, like I say, I think that the best service that we could provide our students is to look at the science about development, look at the things that we want our students to be able to do, and then pursue the means to give our students those skills, follow the science that's going to help them develop into help them develop every part of their body, their mind, their body, and to have good habits so that they can live happy, healthy, productive lives.
Thanks, Nick, for your call. Let's go next to Pat from Oconomowoc. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I think number one, it needs to be pointed out that a lot to do with the problems we have in some of our large urban public school systems is really a breakdown of the family structure. And I know that's a whole other issue, but, my aunt teaches for Racine Unified, and she works hard. She does her job, but she says a lot is just so tough when you're trying to more babysit a lot of kids who don't value education, or you're talking to parents who simply don't care, or they don't show up for parent-teacher conferences, or their kids come to school without a meal. And it's tough, I think, once they get to school to really be able to deal with some of those problems. I was confused on one point, though, because from what I understand, the state of Wisconsin, Badger Care, takes care of just about any family who has children that are in the poverty level. So, if health care seems to be an issue, I would say that either these folks aren't filling out the correct paperwork, or they're not being led to the correct location. Because I've got some friends that are on unemployment right now, both of them, and because they have kids, the whole family gets health insurance. So I thought Wisconsin had something like 98% of their people were covered because of these various programs. And the other thing, he mentioned that health care, something being done on the national level, perhaps would help. Well, I guess I would turn that around and say, okay, if health care costs are one of the reasons why we can't spend enough money on some of these other programs, we all know that, the health care provided for teachers is, probably the best out there.
Peter.
Yeah, I think that I don't have any problem providing, good health care to our teachers, and I'd love to if we could do that for our students as well. And it's very important that students have access to good health care. So in this debate about, for example, where to put this School of Public Health at UWM, I certainly am attracted to those arguments that say that, well, we need to put it where the kids are going to have access to it, the kids who need it the most, the families who need it the most. So, but it is a problem in our schools, and whatever the reason, we need to make sure that our students are healthy, because if they're not healthy, they're not going to be able to learn. As someone who suffered from asthma all my life, I missed a lot of school. We need to make sure that the students who have faced the greatest challenges of poverty and mobility, that they have access to health care and that they have stability in their lives. And I think I'd kind of like to jump to the Rhode Island firing, because, one of the things that disturbs me most about that is that we have no idea, and I'm sure the president doesn't have much idea, about what was happening in the lives of those students at that school and the relationships that some of those students must have had with their teachers. And to disrupt an educational process, I just am confounded by why anybody would think that's a good idea. And we could talk more about it. But that idea of stability, of giving our students, making sure that they're healthy, of trying to make sure that their families understand that their students, they need sleep, they need their rest, they need to do their homework. We do need to educate the parents and make sure that they understand how important this is. How can we do that? We need an engaging curriculum. We need students to want to come to school because they understand why it's important, and they're engaged with what they're doing. So I think that, Pat brings up a lot of really good points. But as we're looking at a national curriculum, let's look at what engages our students and what's good for them, and build a program not from the top down, not one that is only looking at math and reading, But let's develop a holistic program that's going to be really good and challenging for our students.
We're going to talk more about the Rhode Island decision, which has a lot of people hopping mad and has other people saying, all right, let's go this direction. Joining our conversation is Professor Barry Goldman Hall from San Jose, California. He is on the faculty of the School of Social Work at San Jose State University. And Peter saw the piece that he wrote. It was in a letter to the editor in yesterday's New York Times, The Fired Teachers, in which he talks about the Rhode Island staff that was fired. And he writes, with all due respect, President Obama inherited an unprecedented mess when he took office, including the devastating effects of the Bush-Cheney administration's No Child Left Behind and the Iraq-Afghanistan war budget. Public policies that have left every child behind, but to hold shamefully underpaid and overworked public school teachers solely responsible for the performance of students in a poor community with a large immigrant population is reprehensible and short-sighted. We'll be continuing our phone calls, too, and let me introduce Professor Barry Goldman Hall. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. And also in our studios, Peter Blewett, who's vice president of the Milwaukee School Board. So the two of you will be speaking together. And we were just getting into the issue of the Rhode Island decision. What is this? And you can only see this being replicated in other school districts throughout the country because you have the president saying this is a good way to go. You've got the ramifications of No Child Left Behind. You've got the race to the top, et cetera. That we're probably going to see more of this. And I guess the question is, why? Why are we going that direction, that tough love way to go? But, and this seems pretty dramatic to get rid of the whole staff.
I absolutely agree. I think in times of this, in times of crisis, and I think we're certainly in crisis in the country and both in public education, we're looking for a scapegoat. We're looking for someone to hold responsible for this. And the public teachers, I think, are an easy target. And I'm not quite sure why that is, but I think they become an easy target. I mean, there were so many factors. I just caught the last piece of your other speaker just a few minutes ago, and I can't agree more. There's so many factors that go into both school success and school performance. So teacher competency is certainly one, but there are so many other factors. And when we take into account poverty and language skills and parents, those kinds of things. So I think we're looking for someone to blame here, and I think the teachers have become a significant target. Mm-hmm. And it's very sad, very saddening to me.
If I might just add to that, I think that I don't understand the particular school, why the president would have knocked that school and praised a school in Providence, Rhode Island, and called the Met. Now, let's look at the two schools. The president praised the Met in Providence, Rhode Island, and he said, you know, we have to close Central Falls because only 7% of the students are proficient in math, and the graduation rate is 48%. The school that he praised, the Met, has exactly the same percentage of students who are deemed to be proficient readers, 55%. Both schools, the Met and Central Falls. At Central Falls, 7% of the students are proficient in math. That's not acceptable. But the school that the president praised, only 4% are proficient in math. Only 4%. And what's the difference? The Met is graduating more students. 75.6% of their students graduate. But here's the question, and this is a question that Diane Ravitch asked. She said, how can a high school where only 4% of the students are proficient in math and only 55% are proficient readers produce a graduation rate of 75.6%? To Diane Ravitch, it appears that the school with lower graduation standard rates higher in President Obama's eyes. And that, I think, is a really good question that she raises. The school that he praised, fewer students are proficient in math, about the same number in reading, but they graduate more students. And that, to me, is more alarming. They're graduating students who are not proficient in math. The question should be asked, I think, why is he praising a school that's graduating students who can't do math? The other school had a higher percentage of students who can do math. So I just don't understand the selection process.
Right.
If we're going to...
And I don't understand whether or not we're seeing the beginning here of a lot of staffs being fired around the country for maybe questionable reasons or for low performance, standardized test scores, et cetera. Do you think this is beginning of tough love all over the country, Professor Goldman Hall?
I guess my first response to that is this is an administration that didn't practice tough love with Wall Street and the bankers. And in terms of the bailout, and now we're holding public school teachers responsible, and we're going to start with them, a population of, I believe in my heart, incredibly hardworking individuals. Not all of them, but I think that's true of any discipline, but incredibly hardworking folks who work for less than most college graduates would even consider a decent wage. So I'm not sure why they became the target. I do think this is a trend. I think the article in the San Jose Mercury News this morning was about low-performing schools and how it was very political. I think the comments of the gentleman just before me. How did they decide? They had seven schools who were very low-performing, and they were considering massive layoffs and firings, and now there's only five schools that are poor-performing, and it was more about the politics of the decisions than the actual validity of the decision. So I do think this is coming more. It's here,
but
you know.
Let's go back to phone calls. We have a ton of people who want to talk. Let's go to Scott from Madison next. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm really concerned by how many people. I'm a teacher in Madison, and it concerns me how many people make excuses for teachers. I mean, I want more local control, where teachers that are not performing are removed from the buildings I'm in. I mean, I see it happen where administrations or unions protect these teachers that clearly aren't performing. Now, I don't think you should fire a whole school. That doesn't make sense because obviously there's some people in there with some merit. But there needs to be more local control. And the Race to the Top program is at least trying to motivate schools to start going towards something of a structure like that. And until we do that, we're going to have the same problems going over and over again. I'll just take the answers off the air.
Thanks, Scott. Peter?
I don't see. I think that he's right. We have to have area of reform that would be good would be to look at teacher evaluation and make sure that we have the best people in our schools to do this work. We need to, you know, pay a good wage, and they need good benefits to be able to attract these people to work in very demanding and challenging systems. I know Madison has an incredible challenge. It's the gap between students of color in their performance is larger in Madison than it is in Milwaukee. So I know tremendous challenges. We need to get the best teachers there. We need to invest in professional development so those teachers can make the most of their skills. And we do need to get teachers who are not performing. You know, we need to be able to remove them from the classroom. That I have no problem agreeing with that. If I don't know that I can base my decision on whether they're a good teacher or not on a standardized test. We need appropriate methods of evaluating our teachers, and that's going to change depending on the discipline those teachers are in and what level they're teaching. So, I'm thinking that you can't have real one size fit all kind of solutions for the enormously complex challenges in education. But yes, let's get teachers who are not performing out of the classroom and attract teachers who are doing well into the classroom. I have no problem with that, but I'm not going to support a system that's not based on where we can't evaluate teachers with a good system.
Professor Goldman Hall, do we have models of schools throughout the country that have all of these tough challenges of children who are poor, parents who may be unemployed, people who are speaking English as a second language, tough problems at home, tough problems with not having role models for finding work and getting a successful life. I'm wondering if we should be emulating those or if we know how to get there. I question whether or not we get there by firing the staff of one well, school. But how do we get there?
Well, I actually think there are models. I mean, I think there are models locally here with some inner city high schools here in San Jose. We have a program called Downtown College Prep. It's a very small school. It caters to a great, diverse, ethnically diverse population, inner city kids, poor kids, lots of parent involvement from one of the earlier speakers, a lot of helping parents understand the importance of education, how it works. These are oftentimes parents who did not go to school or grow up in the United States, so they have a different viewpoint on that. So I absolutely think there are models, and in response, in lockstep in some ways with the last two folks who spoke, the Rhode Island decision was such a broad brushstroke. I mean, we're using a flamethrower here when we should be using a magnifying glass. And we do need to hold teachers accountable for being competent, but to fire an entire school and hold them all responsible, we have models. And I think there are people in Obama's administration who know about those models as well.
Mm-hmm. Peter,
it's very reactive.
What about models within MPS? Do we know schools that are functioning that have the same population, people who are economically disadvantaged, who've got issues at home, and still succeed?
Oh, absolutely. And the great thing is we have them at every kind of level and of every shape and size. One of the things that I'm really proud about, two of our schools in Milwaukee Public Schools are the top five public high schools in the state, Rufus King High School and Milwaukee School of Languages. And those schools, both half the children that attend those schools qualify for free and reduced lunch. Riverside University High School has a much higher population of kids who qualify for free and reduced lunch, and they're in the top 25 of the state, right here in Milwaukee. I mean, two of the top five high schools have significantly challenged populations, and they are doing really well. The next closest school is Nathan Hale in West Allison. I think that has 24% free and reduced lunch, and that's in the top 25 too. We have some small schools that are offering great programs. I think of the new school for community service, where every student in that school has to have an internship as part of their graduation requirements. And it's a great school. Students are learning to take responsibility, to get engaged in the community. We should be looking at those models and saying, how can we replicate this? Milwaukee High School of the Arts offers another great opportunity. We have this new Montessori High School, which is groundbreaking. It's serving a high number of kids with special needs. And these are the kind of programs that we should be looking at, that we should be supporting. Again, the race to the top should be about innovation. It should be about research. I think that the broad brush approach, the one size fits all, the competitive approach is not where we should be going.
Yeah. Professor Goldman-Hall, maybe we need to require all politicians, and particularly those who are making decisions about education, to serve at least a 6-month internship in a low performing school. What do you think?
I am all in favor of that. I mean, I'm a social worker, so we're all about internships and training and having our professionals out in the community to get hands-on experience. I'm all for that. I will vote for that.
What kind of response are you getting to your letter?
Thus far, positive. I mean, I actually got some emails from New York from educators who were very much in favor of the letter, and there may be more as well. I've gotten some emails, so a very, very positive response. I am an Obama supporter. This seems so short-sighted to me. I was very saddened by it. So
yeah, and let me ask just one final thing, and then we'll let you go, and we'll take more phone calls. We had an email that came in. I'd like for both of you to respond to this, starting with you, Professor, because Peter's in our studio. And this may not be true, but the email person, who is Carl, writes, "Why are private schools doing so well with little or no money, and public schools seem to be struggling?"
As you read the question, and when I look at the private schools here in the San Jose Bay Area, the greater Bay Area, most of them are very, very well funded. And a significant factor in the private school population is the private schools can dismiss, expel, suspend, kick out, if you will, troubled students. The public schools have to deal with those students, students who come from homes with violence and chemical dependency and poverty and all of those issues. In our community, when those kids go to the private schools and they have problems, they come back to the public schools. And so they have they're much more selective in their student population. So I think they can choose for success, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
Well, I just want to add my I like the letter that Professor Goldman Hall wrote, so I just wanted to thank him for taking the time to write that and congratulate him on getting it published. The question again.
Private schools.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, in Milwaukee, that problem is exacerbated because we have the state-funded private schools, the voucher program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Milwaukee public schools, we have 1 out of 5 of our students has special needs. 1 out of 5.
Really?
And the private schools, less than one, you know, 0.5%. So, in other words, 1 out of every 200 students that walks in their doors has those special needs, which, you know, simply it takes more money to provide those services to those children, and they certainly deserve it. And I mean, you know, as every child does, but that's what we're dealing with. And I would also question, what are the measures? Because how do you know that a private school is doing well? What are you measuring? And who, you know, I don't see the measurements for all the private schools because they're not forced to report that. Even the ones that get the public money. You know, we've made a small move, but I don't think the right move in demanding some accountability from private schools. But we don't. They get state funds. But in Milwaukee, the problem's exacerbated. I think when you have a school that 1 out of 200 kids has these special needs, and you have a school like Milwaukee School of Languages where 1 out of 5 kids has special needs, and you know, we're still doing an excellent job at Milwaukee School of Languages. Mm-hmm. And the great thing is that the students there are – the students there, it's a diverse environment. And mm-hmm. so they get that – that's a wonderful experience.
Yes, it is. That's a life experience. Professor Barry Goldman Hall, thank you so much for writing a letter and agreeing to chat with us for a while. I hope you'll join us for another program for a longer period of time.
I would be honored. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks. Professor Barry Goldman Hall, if you want to reference his article, it was a letter in yesterday's March 10 New York Times. He is a social worker on the faculty of the School of Social Work at San Jose State University, and he was writing about his disappointment in the president and in the administration for their tough love endorsement of a Rhode Island school board's decision to fire the entire faculty of a poorly performing school. More phone calls for Peter, vice president of the Milwaukee School Board, in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Thursday, Marilyn Johnson, author of This Book Is Overdue, How Librarians and Cybrarians Can Save Us All. We go to more calls now. Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
As you've discussed, this issue is more complicated than just the schools themselves. It's the communities, it's the families, it's the expectations we have of kids. But I still think we need standards across the board that every school has to meet. I think we also need to value each child by putting a dollar amount in every child in the United States of what they're worth from the government, federal government, and from the state government. Every child would be equally valued. And this would then prevent schools from dropping these kids and not dealing with their issues, because it means you lose money if you lose this kid. The other thing I'd like to see is to reinforce from the teacher standpoint in schools and how they're doing as an independent certification group like we have for hospitals. We have JECH. They would come in instead of just having the DPI down in Madison. It would be an independent group. It wouldn't be politically motivated, and they would be enforcing these standards and reviewing the classroom, how teachers are teaching. If teachers are meeting test results or graduation, they would be the money would be also attached to how they're doing the schools.
Okay. Peter, your response.
Well, I like that idea. I really, you know, having taught at the university level, you know, when the North Central comes in to accredit you, they do a really holistic kind of look at what you're doing, and you know, then they base their accreditation upon that. And I think that that kind of evaluation is much more helpful to boards and to parents and to the community than the way that we do accountability now. So I think that's a good idea. North Central, the one sort of caution I have is with the voucher schools. The plan they put in place has created kind of a cottage industry for some people, and I get a little bit nervous when people stand to make a lot of money by getting into the accreditation business. So we do, I think that we, the state needs to be very clear and very, they need to put into the request for proposals very strict guidelines about how that's done and what's required and what's expected and how that's going to be, you know, compensated. We don't want to create an industry that is going to give us a lot of PR and not have a lot of and not be based on good, solid information. So, but it's a good idea.
Yeah. Thank you for the call. We go next to Derek from Round Lake. Hi, Derek.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Good show. As someone who had experience getting educated in Europe as well as Japan and here in the United States, I got a sort of a question which I think really troubles me. My two boys were born here in this country. And as far as the educational performance is concerned, and also looking from other countries' experience, why is the American educational system so pathologically incapable of looking at other countries' experiences, what works, what doesn't work? And any time I would bring this issue up with either school district or superintendent or Board of Education, I'm always getting a flat-out response of quote-unquote American exceptionalism, where the things are so diverse here that, you know, not, nowhere else is like this, which is not true. You look at a French experience, either in the Paris suburbs, Balius, or even Malmö in Sweden, where you have immigration population, 50-60% of population attending school, however, much higher degree of math proficiency as well as educational. And I would like to hear the response. Why is that?
Okay.
That's a great question, and you are – that's the question that I ask. I mean, we do see these great models. I mentioned earlier, you know, the Netherlands kids are learning four languages, and they're – as a result, the English speaking in the Netherlands is better than it is here because students are so verbally articulate, and I think that that's a great question. You know, I remember when No Child Left Behind was announced and there was a Rod Page had written a letter, the former Secretary of Education, saying no other civilization in the history of the world has attempted to educate all of its citizens. And I thought, wow, I guess you haven't been looking around the world. There are lots of societies that are making a huge effort to educate every one of their citizens. And I think doing it in a more appropriate way than we do here. And it's a very good question. I'm sorry. We need to look at every example and take the best from around the world and give that, you know, provide that to our children. We have a lot to learn mm-hmm. from other countries, and I think it's arrogance to think that we don't. So I absolutely applaud that remark because I think it's a good observation. And, you know, by insisting, for example, not worrying about language instruction because everybody has to speak English, you know, that kind of arrogance actually hurts our children. Our children should be learning other languages. It's good for their own. It will improve their own use of English, and it will develop brain capacity. It will develop their verbal skills. And to not have that opportunity, we are handicapping our students in a world that's becoming more competitive, you know, through the internet right. and these other. So, yes, absolutely, our speaker's right.
Dan from Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm calling because I have a little bit of experience in Milwaukee Public Schools. A couple of years ago, I interned at Pulaski High School. I'm an aspiring teacher myself, so.
Good for you.
And then, Mike, I went to Pius High School, and my sister, right now I'm her legal guardian, and she goes to Nathan Hale. So I've kind of had that experience where I've seen really good schools, and then at Pulaski I've seen a slightly subpar school, in my opinion. And I think one of the big issues is just engaging the parents. I mean, you guys talked about before engaging the students. I mean, I think engaging the parents is easily just as important because sometimes we assume that parents are intrinsically going to want their kids to go to school, and sometimes, unfortunately, that's just not the case. Some parents are just disinterested, or maybe they're too busy, and sometimes we have to engage them mm-hmm. in making sure that their child's education is, you know, one of their top priorities.
It makes a big difference. We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, all the research shows you got the best school system in the world. If the parents are not engaged, those students are not going to learn. On the other hand, you could have a very poor school system, and if the parents aren't engaged, those kids are going to learn despite the obstacles. That is absolutely critical, and I believe, you know, any federal effort really should take into account how can we get these parents engaged? How can we get them to make sure that their kids are getting the rest, getting the nutrition, and are doing their homework and are, you know, at school on time every day?
Yeah. Thanks, Peter, very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Thank you. There's so much to talk about with education. I love this topic. Peter Blewett is Vice President of the Milwaukee Public School Board. And we also thank Professor Barry Goldman Hall at San Jose State University for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanny for producing this interesting hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll return with another hour of Thursday Conversation. The focus of next hour will be librarians. It should be a very lively talk with the woman who's written a book about librarians and how quirky they may be and incredibly valuable. So stay tuned. Coming up in just a few moments here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.